Hello and welcome to the WPHP monthly hold on.
It's a bonus episode? Are you sure?
Yeah, no, those interviews were really good. We couldn't include everything in the big episode. It would have been so long. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. A bonus episode. All right.
Where was I?
Right.
Hello and welcome to the WPHP Monthly Mercury, the podcast for the Women's Print History Project. My name is Kate Moffitt, and I am one of the hosts of this podcast and a longtime editor on the WPHP. The start of the school year is upon us, and I'm here to kick it off with the first of a series of bonus episodes that expand on our very affectionately dubbed Frankensteinian episode for Bars Nasser 2022 New Romanticisms. In the process of making that episode, we interviewed each of the keynote speakers for New Romanticisms, and our conversations with them were delightful, brilliant, generous, and wide-ranging. They were also too long to include in their entirety in one episode of reasonable length. And so we bring you this, a series of five bonus episodes containing those interviews, which we're so excited to share. This episode is an interview with Dr. Jenny Batchelor, whose keynote was the Bars Marilyn Butler Memorial Lecture, titled To Rescue from Oblivion What Might Have Been Forgotten, The Ladies' Magazine and the Remaking of Romantic Literary History. Jenny Batchelor is head of the Department of English and Related Literature and professor of English at the University of York. Her most recent book, The Ladies' Magazine, 1770 to 1832 and the Making of Literary History, came out during the conference in August 2022. And it's open access, so we are going to link it in the blog post for this episode for you. Enjoy our conversation with Dr. Batchelor about all things romantic and capital R romantic, periodicals, and not-so-frantic novels.
So, Jenny, thank you so much for joining us today to chat about your keynote at Bars Nasser 2022 New Romanticisms. We're so excited to be talking to you about it. And to start us off, I think we're going to just ask, if you had to describe your keynote in one sentence or question, how would you describe it?
Well, if I was doing it one question, I guess it would be a very short question, which is, why bother to read the Ladies' Magazine now? That would be the question. And the sentence would be, you need to read it because everybody was reading it.
Oh, fantastic. Very provocative. We're actually doing this interview at the time, the day after Jenny's given her keynote, so coming out of it yesterday, I am absolutely feeling like I need to go read it. So you did a great job.
You did exactly
what it was supposed to do.
You conveyed it perfectly. So just to follow up on that, in your keynote, you talked about how the Ladies' Magazine has been marginalized by scholarship because it looks unromantic. Mm-hmm. So we just were wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about what it means for something to look unromantic. And does that necessarily mean that it is?
Right. Okay. So I need to clarify, because you're hearing the word unromantic, not seeing it on a page in front of you if you're listening to this. So I guess I mean both unromantic with capital R romantic and lowercase romantic too. So if I can take the last one of those first, because that's kind of easier. One of the things that is responsible, I guess, for the historic marginalization of the Ladies' Magazine is that, you know, we can go right the way back to when Charlotte Bronte was reading it and her dad burnt a stack of them that belonged to Charlotte Bronte's mother, because Charlotte was, as she says in a letter that she wrote in December 1840, she was running away when she should have been minding her lessons and reading and devouring stories from the magazine. And her father, Patrick, said, you know, this was not on because the magazine contained foolish love stories. Mm-hmm. And there is a perception, which we still have, of course, about women's magazines. We tend to associate them with romantic plots and stories and short fiction and a kind of romantic fantasy of what a woman's life is or could be. Right. And, you know, you only have to read just a few pages of the Ladies' Magazine to realize that Patrick Bronte clearly hadn't read it, because if he had, he would know that the magazine is very cynical, actually, about marriage and love. It's a very pragmatic magazine, which is, I see very much in part as a kind of, it's doing lots of things, but one of the things it's doing is providing a kind of navigation aid for women in a world where it's very difficult to be a woman, actually. So it's unromantic in that sense, in terms of, you know, sort of love and courtship and marriage, it's very cynical about that. But in terms of the more interesting question, I guess, which is why it's capital R romantic, I guess one of the things that I've been interested in this project, but more generally for a number of years, is how, you know, the romantic, the capital R romanticism, is a very useful term in so many ways for us in structuring books and courses, but it's also quite an exclusionary term. And I have a real problem with that. I'm also very interested in the way that so many of the ideas we have about what constitutes literature in general, you know, since the Romantic period is so much bound up in what some Romantic theorists thought literature was. In other words, we're the kind of legatees of the Romantic.
We're downstream from it.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of romantic ideas about authorship, which are, you know, being debunked all the time. But, you know, like, for instance, you know, the author is an original genius, a solitary figure who's sort of working outside of or above the common concerns of life. I mean, like, that's just not right. how it was, yeah. right? And so one of the things that I find so very compelling about the Ladies' Magazine is it, you know, it runs from 1770 to 1832, so a kind of generous early-ish romantic period, I guess. But it's one that is very aware of what's happening. It's envisaging these changes that have become quite normative kind of categories for us, normal ways of thinking about what constitutes literature. And it's challenging them in the very moment that they're being articulated. So I think it's unromantic in that sense. Mm. That doesn't mean, to answer you the follow-up question, it doesn't mean that just because it looks unromantic. I mean, it does look... Yeah. It does also look unromantic physically on the page. It's miscellaneous. Mm-hmm. It can look bewilderingly chaotic trying to read this thing. But just because it looks unromantic, does that mean it's unromantic? Well, I think it is actually unromantic in the sense that it is challenging ideas that we now or for a long time have associated commonly with romanticism, and doing so in very provocative ways. You know, it's telling its readers or advising its readers to read people that conventional romantic theories, say, coming from the preface to lyrical ballads, would say, don't read these frantic novels. And the Ladies' Magazine is saying, hang on a minute, these novels are not really frantic. They're saying really important, interesting things about how we can live our lives. They're written by very interesting people. I think it looks unromantic, and it is unromantic. It wants to be unromantic.
But it's pushing back against that established definition.
Right.
Or you know, kind of demanding that the scope of it be broadened.
Precisely.
Right. Oh, fantastic. So a fascinating and very successful element of your research into the Ladies' Magazine has been your public engagement through activities like Stitch-Offs. I feel like I've seen posts about this all over my Twitter feed, which is so exciting and cool. I do a lot of different like fibery arts. I've got embroidery and crocheting and knitting and all sorts of things. Oh. So I was always super excited to see that in my little academic Twitter sphere. But can you speak to how doing activities like this have informed your scholarship on the magazine?
Yeah. So, well, I guess, I mean, in general terms, I think I've never seen research and public engagement as two strands of what I do or that really any academic should do. I think that's partly just because of my own kind of career. I started my first job after my PhD was working at Chawton House when it was just opening, and so amazing. Engaging the public and in the work that we were doing there as a group was just really important. So it's always been key to me to think about the work we do as speaking outwards from universities and classrooms. But I would say the other thing, I mean, for this project on the Ladies' Magazine, it seems so important to me to make the research public and to make it as freely available as possible, partly because this is popular literature. It was very widely read. You know, the magazine had a huge circulation by contemporary standards of about 15,000 copies a month at its height. But also the publication itself was very much a community effort and a collaborative effort. So much of the magazine was produced, certainly for its first 50 years, by its readers. So anyone who wrote the magazine could write stuff for it. They could be part of the textual community that the magazine set up. They would talk to each other through its pages and so forth. And I wouldn't say that I had an intention of kind of trying to in some way. It wasn't strategic in that sense, but it just felt natural to me to make the project as community oriented as the magazine was. In terms of the patterns, that sort of, and the stitching, that kind of happened by accident because I'd been looking for patterns in the magazine, which were published every month. It's needlework patterns for the first 50 years of its run. So I knew there was about 650 of these things. And when I originally had come to the magazine a long time ago on a different project, which was on fashion, I'd wanted to write about these and I couldn't because I hadn't found any of them. Right. They'd all been taken out and used. Mm-hmm. And anyway, long story short, one day a copy of the magazine came into my hands, and I couldn't believe it because it had six of them in there. And it turns out,
that's,
you know,
so exciting.
It just turns out needlework patterns are like buses, and I had six. I'd been spending 15 years. I now have about 70. I've now seen about 300. But when I had the original six, I just put them out there on social media in a kind of, oh my goodness, look at this. And people just loved it. People were so engaged by it. And I thought, okay, this is another route to engage mm-hmm. people in the magazine. Yeah. And they started asking questions about it, like, how would you have done this? Who would have done this? How would they have done it? What would they have done this for? Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, great. So because the patterns weren't published with instructions, some of those questions can be quite hard to answer if you don't work with this stuff. Right. So the best way of answering those questions was actually to do them, to recreate them. Mm-hmm. And for me to learn from the other people who took it upon themselves, hundreds of people. We had a wonderful exhibition of many of these, the results of this at Chawton House back in 2015. And people are still making them now, was to get people involved in that. And I've learned so much. I've learned so much about the kind of creativity that the patterns allow, the kind of license and trust that the magazine extended to its readers. It's given me all sorts of insights that I would not have had into the magazine and its readers that I would not have had if we hadn't done that work. So yeah, it's really important to me. It seems absolutely, it's important in general terms, I think, for our work to speak outwards, as I said, but I think particularly for this, to be working on a publication that was so popular, was so engaged with its audience and its community, to kind of to bring that back is really important. And I have learned, without any words, I have learned so much from the people who engage with the magazine's content on social media and other forums, and yeah, it just endlessly teaches me. It's really helped the research massively.
Yeah,
amazing. So I believe it was mentioned in the introduction to your keynote yesterday that today is your new book's release date.
I think it is, yes. It was certainly, I think it is. I haven't actually physically seen it, but
did
I believe
sneak up
so.
On you?
I think so.
Congratulations.
So, thank you.
So much of your keynote yesterday came from that book. So obviously you couldn't present your entire book to... We might have sat there and listened to the whole thing, but maybe not the whole conference. So what is something that you really wanted to fit into your keynote but just didn't fit?
Yeah, it was so hard because there's so much to talk about, and I didn't know. I really tussled with which aspect to focus on for this talk. But I think the thing I would have liked to have been able to talk about a lot more was, well, the contributors to the magazine. So a lot of the content is repurposed from other publications. Mm-hmm. So you'll see, you know, extracts from Cook's journals or Byron's poetry, whatever. But the content that really interests me is that produced by the reader contributors, because there's thousands and thousands of them, some of whom later became famous or who were already famous, like, say, Clara Reeve, or people like Mary Pilkington, who are well known outside it, but it wasn't known that she wrote so much for the Ladies magazine. People like Radegunda Roberts, who I'm obsessed with, who is this wonderful woman who was a translator and an essayist.
I've never heard of her.
Well, we should hear about her. She published outside the magazine. She published sermons. She was the first English translator of Marmontel's Tales. She was very, very important. Very, very important writer. And she writes for, I think, about a decade in the magazine under different pseudonyms, but we can track them all back to her. So thinking about these writers, not all of whom were women, they included people like George Crabbe, John Webb, and other writers and poets and essayists. Thinking about those writers, you know, what drew them into the magazine, the kind of works they produced, thinking about the extraordinary audiences that they would have had. I mean, you know, a line I use in the book is that one contributor I'm very interested in is called Elizabeth Yeames. She was from Norfolk. Her sister also wrote for the magazine. As far as I know, she didn't publish outside it, but she always wrote under her own signature in the magazine. I thought she died. I got very sad one day because she stopped being in the magazine, and I was really upset. And then doing some genealogical research, which I've done a lot on for this book, I found that she got married, which hopefully was better than dying. And her name became became Mrs. Robert Claiborne, and then hey presto, it's totally continuous. She becomes Mrs. Robert Claiborne in the magazine. Wow. So thank goodness she kept going. But, you know, in 1811, if the circulation figures we think we have are correct, you know, more people would have known of and were reading Elizabeth Eames and Jane Austen.
Right.
I mean, it's, that's just the case. So I'd love to talk more about that, really. There's so many stories one could tell about that. But, that's what I'd like to talk
about.
It's
so interesting. I mean, we say this on every episode of the podcast, which is that we wish we could do periodicals, but we absolutely can't because it's just such an extensive... It would break our data model, not least because so many...
And your spirit probably too.
So many of the contributors were anonymous, right? Yes, so especially when you're thinking about that, it's you know, sometimes it's people who went on to publish outside of the magazine, but sometimes it's people who were part of its readership who are just contributing. And then to track those people down and figure out who wrote what and how.
Yes, a lot of work.
Especially because we're approaching it from this, you know, data side of things, of trying to create that data. And so if the data is hard to track down, how much time can you reasonably give to figuring out one person and how what they did and all that kind of stuff? So it's always – I always just get really excited to hear about these contributors that we aren't able to grapple with in the WPHP because I'm so aware of that being a gap that we miss.
But there will be people in the WPHP who are
well,
in
like
the
Clara
magazine.
Reeve. Mm-hmm. Like Clara Reeve. That's familiar specifically because I've worked on her in the WPHP. So that's pretty cool. Amazing. Let's talk a bit about the conference more generally. The conference is called New Romanticisms, and we would love to know what that name means to you. Like, taken literally, what kinds of new romanticisms are you seeing in the field now? Or more broadly, if you'd like, what do you hope to see for new romanticisms in the future?
Oh, gosh. I mean, yes, the newness of romanticism is being interpreted in lots of really exciting ways in the conference. I guess, and the romanticism that... You know, with all romanticisms that we're talking about today is so is so very different from the romanticism that I encountered as an undergraduate. I guess, in that there are more people, there are more genres, there are more years. It's just expanded in all sorts of ways. But I think, you know, as it's expanding, we're realizing that actually, romanticism is to go back to some of the things we were talking about earlier. Romanticism itself is such an it can be such an exclusive or exclusionary term, and so then I hope, and certainly what seems to be very much the case at this conference, is that the newness is not actually about discovering new things as just really doing justice to the things that were already there and we've forgotten about. And tracing, I think more, and even more excitingly, I think, about tracing genealogies between writers, ideas, concepts, movements, whether political or otherwise, that we chronologically fit within the Romantic period, which we are indebted to, whether we realize it or not, that there is this long moment, so many of the issues that we're facing today in society, we can trace back to the Romantic period, and not in a kind of, you know, presentist sort of way, but saying, you know, actually, what can the Romantics teach us about the climate crisis, for instance? Mm. What can the Romantic, what can texts and writers of the Romantic period teach us about the legacies of colonialism today, about the way that those continuities have affected our own discipline, you know, the way that you know we really need to. It's the part of the newness of the romanticism of this conference, and certainly what I would like to see in new romanticism is a romanticism which is so much more self-reflexive about who we teach, what we teach, and how we teach them, that we sort of have to de-romanticize romanticism in order to do the period and the people who worked and lived within it full justice. And that involves decolonialization. It involves being just much more inclusive and just recognizing that, you know, romanticism is a term. We're talking about a very rich and politically challenging period of history in which a lot of absolutely fundamental things were happening, which we're still living with the consequences of today. And unraveling and unpicking that is going to take a lot of work. And it's just really exciting to see so much of that work happening in the conference, I think.
And I kind of feel like we have, like, the last couple episodes, we kind of keep coming up against this issue of, like, thinking about historical figures as actual people and what that means, I guess, like, ethically, in terms of, like, how can you ever know a historical figure, that kind of thing. So it's something that speaks really nicely, I think, to some of the themes we've been just kind of bouncing around behind the scenes. So just to conclude, and obviously it's been such a rich conference and it's not over at this point, but we just like to hear, is there anything at this conference that you've particularly enjoyed, that has been a kind of standout
I mean, honestly, the fact it's happening is just the fact it's happening, really happening. I mean, virtually and physically happening is just so important. Mm-hmm. And I think I think the way that the conference mm-hmm. is happening, you know, the theme of New Romanticism, as its organizer mm-hmm. Andrew McInnes has pointed out to us, you know, it's become the way that the conference is shaped as well. Mm-hmm. Nice. And I think that there are some innovative formats. Not just the virtual, physical, or the mm-hmm. hybrid sort of format of the conference, which I think is really exciting and mm-hmm. new for us, mm-hmm. and something that's important. But there's an inclusiveness embedded in that, which is also speaks to the kind of the will to inclusiveness in the field, which mm-hmm. is very much, you know, central to it. So I think, I've heard so many great papers, and I wouldn't want to pick out one to just say this sort of emblematizes for me what's so great about this conference. I think it is the nature of the conference, the way it's been organized, the way it's potentially leading the way to new conference formations, I think is the thing that I'm finding really exciting. Oh,
lovely. Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming in and chatting with us, Jenny. This has been so, so lovely. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. A big thank you to Dr. Batchelor for sitting down with us for this conversation and for reminding us all why everyone should read the Ladies Magazine. Because everyone was reading it. If you'd like to learn more about it, we highly recommend reading her book on the subject, The Ladies' Magazine, 1770 to 1832 and the Making of Literary History, which is available open access from the Edinburgh University Press website. This has been the first bonus episode of It's Alive, the WPHP Monthly Mercury at New Romanticisms. If you haven't listened to our Bars Nasser conference episode yet, it is the first episode of season 4 and contains interviews with keynotes, organizers, a pedagogy prize adjudicator, MA students, and grad student prize winners. Next week, we'll be sharing the second bonus episode, a conversation with keynote Noah Herringman. You can keep up with our project by checking out www.womensprinthistoryproject.com or by following us on Twitter at the WPHP and on Instagram at Women's Print History Project.